Last week, we asked a very serious question. In Esther, at the end of chapter 2, when Esther is chosen as the queen, we said that Ahasuerus made a major party. On the simple interpretation of the words, 1, 2, 5, 4. On the simple interpretation of the words, he made a major party. He found himself a new wife. That's an understandable thing. Second weddings are going to be huge, right? He found a young girl. He's making a major wedding. Fully understandable. You know, we had it last summer, 2 summers ago, right? The king, it's fine. King getting married makes a big thing. But then it says in Pasuk Chav, and in Pasuk Yeches, it still says the same thing. He made a huge party, 18, and it says, then the king made a great banquet for his officers. It was Esther's banquet. I mean, she made it known. It's not about my wedding to her. It's about her. And he proclaimed an amnesty for the provinces and gave gifts worthy of the king. This was a major event. Off day, official government holiday. Everyone's off, and he's giving out gifts. Tax breaks. And the question was like, what? Why is the pasuk put this together? So many, many moons ago, we did Esther. Stephen, on? Stephen, many moons ago, we discussed this. That, we're going about 20 years maybe. We discussed him that was one of his ways. We mentioned it quickly last week, so I'm just repeating it. That he, one of his ways to try to get Esther to give up the goods, give up the secret of where she's from, where she come from. He said, listen, I'm giving a blank amnesty day. But if you tell me who you really want me to give special presents to, I'll give more. But as the pasuk says right after that, Ein Esther Megeres Malarata. In English, Esther still did nothing, told nothing of her people, as Mordechai instructed her. For Esther continued to obey Mordechai, and that's he did not say. And we asked at this point in time, this is the question we asked last week, this point in time, what was Mordechai's strategy going on here? Like, why not? Why not take advantage? And go to rabbihavda.com. Last week, we gave a few answers. One big theme. Within the theme, there were several potential explanations. One of them we went over quickly because of Bodenheim, that we're going to repeat again just slowly now so people realize that is an answer. One of them is that when Esther was becoming queen, as we know from America today, practical current events. When Vashti was killed, only one person died. She defied the king, maybe in public, maybe a total embarrassment, maybe a murder malchus, what do you call murder malchus in English? I don't know what the words are. But a rebellion against the king was, it might have been a coup against the king when we went go back to those old classics 20 years ago. Only she got punished. In 1945, by von Stauffenberg, what they killed? Stevie, how many they killed? What they killed? Like 145 generals, even more. They went out like a bunch of people. Even people who were not involved with the von Stauffenberg plot got killed. Because when there's a coup, you just start sweeping up people and get rid of them. Here, only one person died. And Mordechai said, this is what Bode and I meant to do last week. Mordechai said, listen, Esther, this guy's got a temper. This guy switches his opinions every 5 minutes. This guy's got a drinking problem. It all is a bad recipe for him getting angry at you one day. But the difference is, when he gets angry at you, it's not just going to be you. It's going to be all Jewish mankind. Like we see in America today. I was stopped a few months back by a couple of kids from Eastern other religion. A bunch of kids, and they were like, you Jews, you want to kill us all? I'm like, why are you coming to me? I live in America. What does that do to me? I was trying to calm the situation down. And what's the reason that every Jew is being harassed? Now, we know because all Jews are alike. But what do they think? You don't know my opinion on Israel. Maybe I'm the Turek Kartanik and I say it's a terrorist state. Or maybe I'm one of those guys, right? The answer is because when one Jew is being caught, it just looks bad. When a guy a few years ago who got caught with that major Ponzi scheme and got 175 years in jail, right away all the jokes with the Jews are bad. So what Mordechai was telling Esther, which I said to Bodenheim, I remember this last week, he said in the middle last week, wasn't the main answer. What Mordechai was telling Esther was, listen, you got to be alone on an island. Because if something goes wrong, and there's a good chance something will go wrong based on past, if, you know, past history is an indicator of future results, we cannot be in the middle here. As I said last week, you got to fall on the sword yourself. So another answer, which again, we hinted at quickly last week, we went through a whole different methodology last week with 3 or 4 answers. We'll do again today 3 or 4 different answers. But the first one is a recap last week of one small part of last week that is talking about collateral damage. We don't believe in collateral. Mordechai was telling her, we don't want collateral damage. And Mordechai was so right, because if Stephen, if you remember, at the end, what happened? All the Jews went to the party. All the Jews bowed down to Haman. And Haman said, oh, there's one Jew not bowing down to me. I'm going after them all. So we see even then, if you're on 1255, remember we did this, Stephen, in Pasuk 6, it says, when Haman himself saw that Mordechai did not bow down and prostrate himself before him, singular, then Haman was filled with rage. However, it seemed contemptible to him to lay the hands on Mordechai alone, for they made him know that he was the people of Mordechai. So Haman sought to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire kingdom, the people of Mordechai. Mind-blowing. Now, of course, we know something we spent time on. Ahasuerus might have been worse than Haman. That's a debate in the Talmud about Ahasuerus was a bigger anti-Semite than Haman. We don't write it up that way in the story because he was still the king. So you have to be wise about that. But he might have been worse than Haman. So if Haman has, the whole world bowing down to him, but one Jew doesn't, and his reaction is, let's get them all throughout the kingdom, so we can't take a chance.
So does that mean all Jews besides...
All Jews, because one person didn't bow down. And if Esther would have done one thing wrong, all Jews. So we made a deal. Mordechai told Esther, keep quiet. Do not say, Ahasuerus is making a massive banquet. What did we say the word was? It was called Esther's banquet. He's offering gifts. Don't be a fool. Those gifts come with potential large strings attached to them. Large strings. If we remember, we had this conversation many, many moons ago. Stephen's on. Decades ago, Stephen. We've discussed that there's a right-wing segment in the religious population in Israel that do not take any money from the Israeli government. None. When for years, when they were offering for students to make X amount of money, they never took a dime. And their attitude was, because at a certain point, the money comes with strings. And most of the religious world, as we know from the fights in the army, we're not getting into politics right now, most of the religious world does take not only tax breaks, but actual handouts, if we use such a phrase. And this section, not a small minority, but a decent amount of people, and the ones are famously is Brisk, the Brisk of Derech, which has multiple yeshivas in Israel, they never took a dime. And one of their attitudes was, that gift comes now, it comes with strings. So Mordechai was telling Esther, listen, he's offering the world, don't take a chance, because the day he gets angry at you, we're all in trouble. Haman got angry at me, we're all in trouble. So answer number one for tonight, we're going to do more in a second. Answer number one tonight, why did Mordechai, way before any threat level appeared, told Esther, keep quiet, because on the chance something goes wrong, let's keep it small. When a Jew does, and by the way, the Goyim think it, as we've said in the past, we in this class on Tuesday night believe in the Zionist protocol. We believe the Jews run the world on a certain level, not the way the Zionist protocols believe we run the world. But we believe that God looks at the Jews and decides how the world goes. And we believe that God says one Jew does affect all the Jews. If a Jew in Hong Kong doesn't keep Shabbos, it affects the Jews, it affects the world. We actually do believe in this. Now, we're not saying if one Jew does something wrong, we should be all wiped out. That's a little scary. But we do believe in this concept of all for one.
You find that in the Tanakh when Achaz multiple steals times. One thing from Jericho and everybody gets punished.
Right.
So Jews could be like a positive effect.
Absolutely.
We are, but not could be. No, we are.
Even the ones who sleep on Tuesday nights.
Right.
We believe that what we do.
Well, or the world
will go bad. As we've said in this class, you want to stop global warming? Keep Shabbos.
But is that really true? I mean,
absolutely. We believe that's a fundamental belief in Judaism. Yeah. Fundamental belief in Judaism that. That we have extra amount that God's watching us to again, it doesn't mean we're better than everybody else. I don't want to be, called a racist. It just means more responsibility. The general is more responsibility than the private. It doesn't mean he's better than the private in any way whatsoever.
Has there ever been a time where the Jews were doing wonderful, but the rest of the world wasn't doing well?
For sure.
Every minute.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you mean?
But the Chofetz Chaim famously said, he made it, there was a, S. Rosen. Was it 1904? Steve, what year was that earthquake in Japan? He did 04, 06, early 1900s. And there was a massive earthquake in Japan. And at that point in time, whether there were or not, nobody in Radin, a small town of 9 cows and 6 people, had any idea if Jews lived in Japan at the time. And the Chofetz Chaim famously said, which is based on a Gemara we discussed, by the way, in Brachas, that thunder, earthquakes, tsunamis, they are happening in the world based on the Jewish response to it, or the cause of it. That means when something happens in the world, Jews must look inwardly and try to figure out what happened. And if you can't, because we're not prophets, what we can do, and usually we know what we can do. Stay awake in a class, learn more, daven better, make brachas better, smirk at the rabbi when you have to. Right? All of these random suggestions. Random suggestions. These are random suggestions. Okay, so that was answer number one. Answer number two, keeps we discussed years ago also. There's an idea that when the messianic revelation occurs and the world sees the truth, hopefully tomorrow,
amen,
what's going to happen is a lot of people, what we call in America, bandwagoners. A lot of the anti-Semites running around now saying, we hate the Jews, they're the capitalists, they're the communists. As soon as the messianic revelation comes, they say, oh, we always love the Jews. We always love the Jews, right? We want to convert to Judaism.
Right.
And that's what's going to happen. But
it's not going to be good. It's like the mixed multitude that went up with Moshe.
Excellent.
Egyptians, they hated the Jews. Oh, you guys, miraculously, we're lovely. Right.
So what happens is in law, it becomes a great debate. And according to many Talmudic passages, when the messianic revelation appears, we will not be permitted in law to accept converts. Too late. The clock has rung out. Is that rung out? Wind out. That's a real thing. The conversion process is only permitted. Now, in Esther itself, the story of Esther, toward the end of the story, it says that many people decided to join the Jews. End of chapter 8 says like this. Likewise, Mordechai left the king present clad in royal apparel of turquoise and white with a large gold crown and a robe of fine linen and purple. The city of Shushan was cheerful and glad. The Jews had light, gladness, joy, and honor. Now, likewise, in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, the Jews had gladness and joy and feast and holiday. Moreover, many among the people of the land professed themselves Jews. And according to the words in Hebrew, it's misyahadim, which means they said they're Jews, which means there was some type of conversion going on. And it was a question, we're going to get to it maybe eventually, was that a legal thing or not? We don't accept Jews when things are going great for us. When things are going great, I would talk about superbly great. Non-Jews are not allowed to convert because we don't trust the conversion anymore. And as Charles correctly pointed out, the first time we saw that live version is when the Jews were leaving Egypt and there were a lot of people saying, we love the Jews. We don't want to lose the Jews and they're our friends. And they joined in, called in English, Hebrew, the Erevrab. I don't think
mixed, mixed multitude.
And throughout the desert, 40 years, they caused a lot of problems. Because the idea of the people joining when they shouldn't join anyway, and it becomes a legal matter as well. So now, it's possible to say, there's not my own answer, I saw this, possible to say, similarly, we said last week, that one of the reasons Mordechai did not allow Esther to reveal her nationality, the nationality or religion, whatever, is because he didn't want all intermarriage happen. On a cousin to that, is he didn't want everyone saying, look, Jews have someone in the White House, Jews are the best, let's become Jewish. Let's join Team Jew. You know why? Because if I go to Esther's banquet and I say, listen, I'm a Jew, I got my green card in, I don't got building codes, I don't pay taxes, so people might be joining the Jew card if she would admit she was a Jew. But Mordechai said, which is amazing, by the way, if you stretch this out, this is the rabbi's sword, say, it doesn't fully say, it sort of says it. That means Mordechai said to himself, listen, there's going to be a great redemption coming up soon. And at that point in time, we don't accept converts. So what do you know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to give them the opportunity now. I'm not going to rise to the top right now. I'm going to allow us to be where we are. Esther in the White House, nobody knows who Esther is. Rely on the Esther staying neutral. It's not negative necessarily, but we're not exactly popular here in Babylon, in Iraq, Iran, and Bubble. We're not popular. And the advantage is with the non-Jews, if they want to see the light, they got a chance of coming in. What I like about this idea is something we've discussed in the past many times, is that too often our leaders do things and people look at them as the negative effect created out of it, not realizing that really they're doing a selfless act for the greater good. So here, Mordechai has the chance to personally benefit. She's the woman I raised. I know her well. I'm related to her. Married the queen. I mean, they're all coming out of the woodworks. To get the goodie bags, to get the grab bags. And Mordechai said, you know what? I will gain. You know who's going to lose? The non-Jews are going to lose. The non-Jews who have a chance to convert are going to lose. I don't want to make them lose. So he went out of his way to lose on his own and not get the grab bags and saying, I know the queen. She's from us, in order to give opportunity for the world. So even though too often political events, we put this on a two-minute clip to send out, even though too many of the world think that the Jews are only out for themselves, the negative and all of that type of stuff, there are great leaders who at times are saying, you know what, I'm going to lose out personally, but for the greater good, not only of the entire Jewish world, but of the entire non-Jewish world as well. For the greater good of the entire non-Jewish world, you have a chance to convert legally. Do it. Now, just as a side, we said here before that people profess to be Jews. And we asked the question, was that legally allowed? Which we, Stephen, do you believe we're going to get to the end of chapter 8 in the near future? Unlikely. So we'll say it now, that there is one interpretation of an early commentator who explains that that pasuk is not what occurred at that moment, but the ending time, which means that only during the 11 months from when Haman got killed, if we remember the story, Haman gets killed on Pesach, and the war occurs on Purim 11 months later. And the war is a smashing victory in a couple of days, day or two. At that point in time, when it says here, Mordechai's walking out, and people want to press the Jews, no, that's when it ended. The only time they were allowed to join Jews, to convert, was, of course, before, but during those 11 months, when the Jews were in very fearful situation. Because even once Haman got killed, the decree didn't stop. Even once the letters went out in Sivan and said, okay, the Jews could defend themselves, didn't ever say they were Jews, they could defend themselves, it never came out directly that the Jews were going to win. There was still a war about to happen. Well, about to means within 8 months.
But whose forces would have fought that war? That's the question.
That was the debate that was going on at the time.
Was there going to be an actually government military that was going to attack the Jews?
It was very unclear.
Was it supposed to be like this peasant?
The locals were told. I just saw now. I'll tell you a story. Everyone likes stories.
Vigilantes.
Maybe you'll take this clip outside and I'll tell you why. So this week in my show, someone donated, sponsored Charles Shudis. So usually I try the show tries, when someone donated Charles Shudis, say a few words about the person you're giving an honor, parent, uncle, or grandparent. Say something about them. So this week was a person who is about 90 years old, and he was dedicating it to his father. So I said, say it about your father. So he said, listen, I have a lot to say. It's not enough time in the Charles Shudis to say, but I want to say over a little bit about what occurred. So he came from a town called Bardiov in Slovakia. The only reason I knew Bardiov is because in my upcoming Agada, plug on RabbiHubba.com, but in my upcoming Agada this year, I have my biographical snapshots like in my other books. I always put a biography about the people, not all of them, but most of the people I'm writing about. And I remembered that one of the grand rabbis, who of course had passed away without kids, that's why he's in the Agada, and I wrote about him, in one of his pit stops, if you use such a phrase, where he was a rav and had a yeshiva, was Bardiov. So I remember the name. This is the early 1900s, before this guy was alive. So after, what happened was, they came back after the war in his town of Bardiov, which initially pre-war, had 2,800 Jewish, I don't mean to say people or families, probably people, came back after the war, 290 people. So basically 90%, that's it. And when they came back to the town, the non-Jews were living in the houses, obviously, right? Where did the Jews go? They went to America. Why should we take their house? So the Jews were coming back, and they, in many towns, when you showed up, it wasn't a good end. We've discussed that. In Bardiov, the police chief, a non-Jew, was a lover of Jews, saved Jews during the war in his basement, which he told me is a great story, and then after the war came back to their homes. And this guy was telling me, he's 90 years old now. We're going back 80 years ago, right? 75 years ago. And he went in with his father and mother. They were saved the whole story. And the guy within, like, no, it's been our house for generations we've been living here. And the police chief came in and said, listen, I've been police chief for a long time. I know what's going on here. I'm fully aware. I have all the records. And he opened his jacket, revealing his weapon, and he said, you have 12 hours. But if I come back in 12 hours and you're here, I'm not speaking with you. This thing is going to do the talking for me. This kid, he's 90. He was there. Amazing. And then, at that point in time, he got his house back. And he said in his first year, 1945, Passover, they found a matzah factory that was not destroyed. They baked matzahs. They had meat, but they had no one who was capable properly at a slaughter. So they couldn't do it. They didn't have any meat. And they couldn't get any grape juice. Chicken. So matzah they had.
Oh, chicken?
No, that's what they said. Okay. But they called to a rabbi. They sent like some telegram to a local rabbi who they knew was Chashev, one of the Dibre Chaim's grandchildren. And he told them, the Seder, the Seer, and Bardiyov, make the four cups on milk. And have a milchika Seder. Mm. Casserole. It's casserole milk. It's not even enough. And he said he did it. He said he remembers 1945. He had a milchika Seder. I don't know why I brought this up just now. I'm trying to say is that when the Jews are downtrodden and you help the Jews out, that's what I want to say. I don't remember anymore now.
You brought it up. Today's Daf Yomi talks about intoxicants like wine. And it says there's two other intoxicants, honey and milk.
That's no way. Great job. Unbeknownst to me, great job by me. That's a gift from God, but great job by Chaskel for knowing that. But what I was saying is that when the Jews are downtrodden, you don't get credit. You get the credit if you want to join. But why was I saying this? I don't remember now. Something about the people giving up for the greater good.
Can I ask one real quick question?
Yes.
So my question is, when the Jews are doing good, is the rest of the world also influenced by that? Or
excellent.
When the Jews are doing bad, and then it has also an effect?
That's a brilliant question.
So my question is, was there ever a time that you could think of that the Jews were doing phenomenally well, but the rest of the world was acting?
That's a bomb question. The easy answer, and there's no easy answer. The easiest answer I can give you while standing on one leg, before we get back to Esther, is it depends on the level of greatness and what they are doing, both the Jews and the non-Jews. So, for example, if the Jews are doing great, but per their level, there's something wrong, that might affect them, or if the non-Jews are on an extreme level. But otherwise, there are times when the Jews are doing great, the whole world benefits. And there will be times when the Jews only benefit. Talmud talks about it. Very good question.
There's a Malik. I mean, a Malik.
A Malik is always
basically,
bad.
Exactly. So,
but their negativity
is going to be against the Jews.
Yes. Yeah. Since the days of Sinai and prior, there's going to be anti-Semitism in the world until the Messianic revelation comes, and then we'll get the bandwagoners jumping on. Then we'll get the back. So what we point is, I thought it was that story. That even though the rabbis do something bad for themselves, they're doing it for the greater good. People don't realize it.
Mordecai didn't say that he was related because he didn't want people to join, convert for the wrong reason. He wanted them to be able to convert for the right reason.
That's right. So he gave them that's what I was saying. So for this 11 months, there was a...
That's what
I wanted to say. I remember because that's a good question. He said, who was supposed to have the fight 11 months later? Yeah. Who's the battle?
Army, or the peasants
right
now?
So this person, this Bardiyov person, told me, and it's obvious, that when the Nazis took over in their killing machine, it only worked when there was local help. So he said in Bardiyov, he survived because the police chief warned him, his family. He said, the police chief sent a message and said, don't be home tonight, to his father. That's how they got out. Now, as I said, many of the people did not. But that's not necessarily because of the police chief. He was trying to help people and the people got caught. But he said his family, besides the police chief, saved people. He said that's a different story. The police chief personally had people in his basement. The police chief also was sending messages to people, get out. Now, sadly to say, you look through Jewish history, not everyone believed it always. Sadly to say. The police chief tells me, they had nowhere to go. You know, it's not always easy. Not always easy. But he said his family got out. That was all I wanted to say. So who was going to attack? You need the peasants. If the local Ukrainian mafioso, the local Polakin wouldn't have got involved, in fact, there is a general, I forgot who now, one of the great generals of the German, of the bad people, SS people, wrote a biography. And in it, he wrote this line, something like that. He could not, he knows, he was also taking the blame off of him. But he was saying that they could not have been as successful as they were, and they never dreamed they would be that successful, if not for the help of the local anti-Semites, the Ukrainians and stuff. And it's obvious.
That is today, Hamas could not be as successful without the help of the world anti-Semites. Right. Giving them money instantly.
Yeah. I'm saying that's the reverse way, but yes. Yeah. I'm saying the leaders of Germany came in and the local Poles helped. You're saying the Hamas is doing things around. Yes. It's the same thing, it's reverse, because it's always going to work that way. It doesn't matter if it goes this direction or this direction. There's always going to be anti-Semitism teaming up against the Jews. And we discussed many years ago that one of our ways to counteract that is when we team up with each other.
Unity
among the Jews counteracts the unity among the non-Jews.
It's much stronger.
Yes. So when the non-Jews get together, all in the name of, they're destroying the world, let's do that. Their non-Jewish factor is only as powerful as we allow it. When we allow them, not allow them monetarily, we allow them because we're infighting. When we're infighting, then their unity becomes a great demerit. That's the right word, demerit? Mark against us.
Unity powers and powers the unity.
Our non-unity powers their yes unity to make it stronger. And if we would have unity, it would diminish their power. And you know, if you look around, you know, we have work to do. We have work to do. Right?
We saw a video.
I mean, Charles wearing a blue yarmulke. I can't trust this guy's food. You're wearing a gray cap. I don't trust you at all. Not even a white shirt. Right? I'm saying that, and it becomes, sadly to say, now I want to tell you one of the most wild answers I saw. Bodenheim and Stephen are on. Hold on. If you're driving a large ambulance, slow down for this wild idea I saw. Not my own. 250 years ago. If this wasn't a great rabbi, I'd be honest. I would, you know, you could talk to me about that. He says like this. He asked this question openly. He's like clear. You know, some people, you have to figure out that through what they're saying, they answer this question. Back to the original question, Bodenheim, is the question is, why did Mordechai not take advantage of the situation? Why did he tell Esther to keep quiet about it, especially at this time of time when there was nothing on the horizon? And he says, when you see the story many times, it says that Mordechai was hanging around the house, right? He was hanging around the king's house. And it repeats it multiple times. I'll see it right now in front of me. But it used to go to the palace, check up on her. And according to this rabbi, a real one, he says that Mordechai is hanging out. The story turns out the way it does. You're reading the story as is. But there could have been an alternative version of events. And that was Mordechai planning the great escape. He was planning, the word he uses 200 years ago, kidnapping Esther, whisking her away from the palace, and to sneak away. But he realized, he says it a little different than I would have said. I would have said, to finish the statement, like I said earlier, collateral damage. Doesn't go with that. He says he realizes that Mordechai realized that had an order to pull this off, it couldn't be known who Esther was. Because then they would check all the hiding places. The only way to get away with it is if you don't know who Esther is, she's one of 17 nationalities, whatever the number was, 70 nationalities. She could be anywhere in the kingdom. He had 127 provinces. And she has friends in low places everywhere. She can, you know, the secret knock on any door, on anything. So you have to hit the Italian mob, the Russian mob, the South African mob, the African mob, right, the Sudanese. You got to have to all of them, and everyone's saying no, you know what to do. But if you knew that she was Jewish, then you'd go after them directly. Now,
Mordecai's Jewish.
Right, but no.
He's the one who's going to kidnap her.
No, he was going to kidnap Bill without being caught.
Yeah, but then the back goes, so where's Mordecai? Where's that?
Right.
First question is, where's also Mordecai used to hang around her all
right,
the time?
Right, so the question that I thought of that, so I'm going to say too, and I thought we said last week. We said last week that everyone agreed, Stephen said he remembered it 20 years ago, he liked it, that everyone knew Esther and Mordechai were connected.
Right.
Everyone knew that it wound up. So it has to be that Mordechai, again, like we said last week, was going to claim she was adopted, or Mordechai was not going to disappear with her. And claim, I don't know where she went, I'm running an orphanage. Or he was going to disappear with her, but they didn't see that. I'm making this up. And when he was hanging up at the gates, they didn't see it. They didn't have motion sensors and infrared lights. Knowing that the Megillah's writing that Mordechai hung out there, but not that they knew he hung out there.
But if he's
wearing
ashes and sackcloth in the gate, and Esther says, what are you doing? You can't dress like this.
Well, she's sending a messenger at a certain point.
So at some point, she saw what he was wearing.
Yes.
She could see.
Well, at that point in time, I would say it was too late already. At that point, already when the plot's out. And then you want her in.
Right.
You only want to take her back. Let's make the thing calls out. You want to do the kidnapping when the cost benefit, what's the other line? Cost benefit
analysis.
Cost benefit analysis, that why would I have my friends suffer with Achashverosh when the upside is me gaining building codes? Okay, so we won't build illegally and we'll get Esther out of the palace. But when Haman's taken over to kill all the Jews, at that point, the analysis says, no. You stay in and you disrupt, you become a saboteur. Saboteur from the inside out, and we stop at that direction, and that becomes the other way. So we have now. Again, it's to me, when I saw this, I have to be honest, there are some questions in this theory. It's very wild. The reason Mordechai didn't want to say is because from day one he was planning on having a kidnapping to smuggle her out of the palace. Very wild idea to say it. Just in case. We're gonna stop here. And we will continue. Bodenheim likes it, Stephen. We will continue with this question next week for other approaches. And the question once again is, why did Mordechai not take advantage? And why did he tell Esther to keep quiet at this moment in history when very little was going on? It was only more pluses than minuses. Have a great Shabbos.